time again for Midday Eats, our monthly hour on cooking and entertaining. And now that the holidays are over, it's time to ask, how did you do in the kitchen? How'd your big family dinner turn out? What were the results of that new recipe you tried? We're joined again by John Shields of Gertrude's in the Baltimore Museum of Art, and sitting in for Henry Hong of the Thames Street Oyster House, Donna Crivello of Donna's Cafes in Baltimore. We'll compare notes during a holiday post-mortem. Perhaps you tried a new savory or sweet dish, but it didn't turn out the way you had hoped. Or maybe you produced an unexpected success. You're invited to join our conversation and answer the question, how'd it turn out? Midday Eats, after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here, and that music means it's time again for Midday Eats, our monthly foodie hour with John Shields from Gertrude's in the Baltimore Museum of Art and Henry Hong of the Thames Street Oyster House in Fells Point. But Henry's not feeling so well today, so Donna Crivello of Donna's Cafes in Baltimore is back with us. So I guess we call this show John and Donna, or Shields and Crivello, or Crivello and Shields. Nice to see
good.
You, Belladonna. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you,
and
too.
John, Happy New Year to both
happy
of you.
Happy New Year, Dan.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.
Nice to see you, John. I got to mention that John Shields from Gertrude's comes to us after making full preparations for his Kraut Fest, his annual Kraut Fest, which is happening this weekend, but apparently, this thing has become so popular, it's all booked out?
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, the tickets go on sale November 1st, and within a week, they're sold out for both nights, and there's a
it's
waiting
funny,
list.
It's funny, Donna. Yep. People love sauerkraut.
Sauerkraut, go figure.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure.
But, yeah. So you serve a menu that's appropriate for sauerkraut, such as knockwurst, bratwurst?
We go to Binkert's and Ostrowski's.
Binkert's, and Ostrowski's.
Yeah, and we get all kinds of things like that, and we get their bologna, and we make little sliders, and we do sour beef and little dumplings, and anything you could
that's
you can
incredible.
Imagine.
But
so
you can
question.
Actually cook with it. I mean, you baked something
okay.
with it, didn't you?
I was going to
bring this up.
No, I'm sorry. I was going to say, ladies and gentlemen, folks who are listening to Midday, you won't believe it, but John brought a cake in. Well, he usually brings a pastry made by
Doug Wetzel.
Doug the fugitive. Doug Wetzel, your kitchen fugitive. But he's your pastry guy.
He is.
He's really good.
He's amazing, yeah.
So John walks in with a cake today, and he calls it his chocolate sauerkraut cake?
Uh-huh. Indeed.
Please, explique.
Well, it would be great. You know, it makes sense with how did it go, because so many Baltimoreans make sauerkraut for the holidays. So you usually have a lot of it around this time of the year. So this is a great thing to do in the winter.
Come on, and please explain a little bit the marriage of sauerkraut and chocolate, please.
It's almost, you know, like the Coca-Cola cake or something like that.
A little sour.
A little sour. Yeah. Basically, it's a white flour cake, has cocoa mixed into it. But the leavening in it is baking powder and baking soda.
Mm-hmm.
So the acidity from the sauerkraut gives a real nice leavening effect to the cake. Now, you don't put the kraut in straight. You put it into a colander, rinse it several times with water, drain it, and then chop it up. So it makes it really moist. It gives it just a little bit of a tang. And it has an amazing texture in the cake as well.
The texture of coconut?
Yeah, it's almost like coconut's been folded
sour,
in there.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, it's really cool.
My mother used to make a sour milk chocolate cake,
uh-huh.
which I liked because it did have that little bit, not the tang of sauerkraut, that sauerkraut would leave, but it was a little bit sour, right?
Yeah.
And it works with the chocolate. So the theme of this show is, ladies and gentlemen, is How did it turn out? If you were planning a big family meal and you hadn't done a lot of that before and you had plotted it all out for the holidays, maybe it was a Christmas or New Year's feast, how did it turn out? Give us a call, 410-662-8780. Because John and Donna, I'm sure you hear this, right? You do a class. Donna does classes all the time. So people take their recipes home.
They do.
And then they bump into you at the supermarket a couple months later.
And they say, you know, I tried, I made what you made, and it didn't come out quite right. So then you ask the questions, you go down the list, did you use this, did you follow this, did you follow that? And then invariably, you know, when you're home, you might not have something, so you need to know what to substitute. Sometimes people use eggs that are too big when they're baking, or they don't have baking powder, and they'll use baking soda. Baking is a big, big part of Christmas and the holidays, and it's also a big part of the frustration of, you know, if you don't do the same thing every year, and you think I'm gonna wing it a little bit this year, then you're left with something that doesn't rise, or cookies that spread, or something that isn't
cookies
quite right.
Cookies that spread.
Yeah.
Well, Donna, that's an appropriate word, winging it, because I like to wing it. I like to be a little bit creative when I'm doing savoring cooking. But when it gets to desserts and baking, I kind of take a pass, and I let somebody else bring it to the house, or I buy something. Because I find that in baking, you have to be so precise, John. I'm not exaggerating either, right? If you're off just a little bit, you can get into some trouble.
You can get in trouble. But, you know, I think sometimes when you get into a little bit of trouble and you do have some knowledge of baking, it can sometimes take you to another world and you've just discovered a new recipe. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes when we go to try to fix it, we say, my God, I really like that.
This is better.
Yeah, this is better. Well, or it's something that's different and now it's my own.
We don't want to hear just about disasters. You can call in and tell us about something that went really well, surprisingly well. 410-662-8780. So how'd it go? How'd your big dinner turn out? How did that dessert that you planned, how did that go? Your cake that somebody gave you a recipe for, you never tried it before. Tell us how it went. 410-662-8780. You can also email us at midday@wypr.org. George posted on Facebook that he did salmon and puff pastry for a pre-Christmas family dinner. It was delicious. But I'm sure it was, George, but tell us a little bit more about it. Like, did you think it was going to be delicious? Did you find it challenging to make that? Or did you buy the puff pastry? Did you do it yourself? So I'm going to tell you about the bouillabaisse.
Okay.
So Donna, last month when John and Henry were here, I announced that I was going to try the French fish stew known as bouillabaisse following Julia Child's recipe with an eye toward John Shields' recipe for Chesapeake fish stew, which is posted on our Facebook page. It's outstanding recipe. And I did everything Julia said. I went to the fish market. I bought fresh fish. I stood there and watched the guy fillet it. I went to two fish markets to get what I needed. I made a really great stock.
What kind of fish did you use?
I used rockfish and hake and porgy. I'm sorry, I'm not thinking of it all. And cod.
Cod, that's great.
And I used the bones. I asked for the trimmings from the fillets that I was going to put in the bouillabaisse itself.
Yeah, that's important for a good stock.
That's mainly what I did is the bones and the... And I had tomatoes in there, as she called for, and onions and olive oil, all sautéed, and then you build the stock from there. And I must say, that was an incredible stock. She says in her recipe that if you want to make it thicker, richer, and more colorful, add tomato paste. And I wish I had done more of that, because I thought the stock, while it tasted good, was clear. And I like... I guess it's the Italian in me, the Portuguese, I don't know.
That's right.
I wanted it redder. I wanted a redder fish stew, so I wish I had added some more tomato paste because I thought it was a little thin.
What kind of tomatoes? Did you use canned tomatoes?
I used canned tomatoes. Canned diced tomatoes. And then the bouillabaisse itself was cod, hake. I had some other shellfish. I threw in some mussels. Yeah, mussels and some shrimp. I think I can't remember it all now. There was about five kinds of fish in there.
Any fennel?
Yes, fennel. I did. I followed her recipe.
Yeah,
fennel and some orange.
Orange zest.
Yeah. Orange rind.
Rind, yes.
Dried orange rind. Yeah, I followed it. It's a good recipe. You get a great stock from it. And I have leftover stock that I froze that'll make a great fish stew. But I'm going to enhance it, I think, with more tomatoes or tomato paste in the future. Anyway, everybody seemed pleased. People ate it. I want to thank John for the recipe that went with that called the Rouille, which I wasn't familiar with, R-O-U-I-L-L-E, which is made from potatoes,
hot pepper.
A little bit of hot pepper,
garlic
and some butter. And
then the broth.
And the broth from the stock.
Stock, yeah.
And you you sort of basically you're making a mayonnaise. Mm-hmm. See, yeah. It's something with the consistency of a mayonnaise that is used in Marseille in the south of France for dipping the fresh fish from your bouillabaisse.
An aioli would be a nice substitute.
Aioli.
Yeah.
I was going to say, folks, if you ever want to put on something that looks impressive coming out of the kitchen for your guests, a nice big soup bowl full of fresh fish and that stock, people will love that.
Yeah.
If they're fish lovers. Mm-hmm. That's another thing. When you have guests, you got to check with everybody.
Oh, you do, don't you?
Yeah.
You got to check and make sure. Does everybody like fish, number one? And the shellfish is a problem for some people. So you got to ask about that.
Well, we made the... every year now we do the Italian Christmas Eve, the Feast of the Seven Fishes.
I went last year.
Yeah.
It didn't make it this year.
No, and I made a huge pot of zuppa de... it's like a cod, you know.
Oh, cod is great in soup.
Zuppa de pesce, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But I used the salted cod, the bacala. Mm-hmm. So it was a bacala zuppa.
Mm-hmm.
The salted cod and fresh cod and tomatoes and onions and fennel and let it cook for, you know, all of that. Cook for a while and then put the fresh cod in at the end.
Correct.
And
that's what
I
did.
And I made a little.
That's what
I put some anchovies
base.
In too.
Did you?
I thought it needed a little bit more kick, and I pureed some anchovy and stirred that in.
Nice.
Oh, you know, I should have called you, Donna. You know, Julia Child doesn't mention anchovies, but I think this stock could use a little bit of that.
See, that's where you can be creative when you're making something like that.
Yeah.
And you know, you just taste it, and you think it needs one more thing. It needs another layer. It needs a level and a little. You know, did you put saffron in your?
Yeah. I have an old. I put a lot of saffron because the saffron I have is getting pretty old.
Yeah.
So anyway, 410-662-8780. If you'd like to talk with us about how your meals turned out over the holidays or whenever, a new recipe you tried, maybe it was surprisingly successful, maybe it didn't work out so well. You want some advice from John Shields or Donna Crivello? Here's Mary in Columbia. Look at that, Donna. She's calling about her Christmas Eve dinner. Hello, Mary.
Hi, Dan. I had never heard of the Feast of Seven Fishes before this Christmas, believe it or not. And my daughter suggested it. And so anyway, I did. I had a hot crab dip, and then I had Clams Casino.
Mm-hmm.
I had went to this Italian market near where I live, and picked up some great bread, and they had a cold calamari salad.
Mm.
We had that. And then I had the, cioppata or whatever, the Italian seafood.
Cipino, I think.
Cipino,
Cipino.
Yeah.
And I used mussels and cod and scallops and shrimp.
Mm. Sounds great.
I mean, it was really, the whole meal was just out of this world, and I was so excited, and it was fun because it was all new. And as I said, I'd never heard of the Feast of Seven Fishes. So
yeah, anyway. You know, having made the bouillabaisse and listening to you now and Donna, I wonder, why do we only do this on Christmas Eve? This is such a great meal. I mean, seafood's not cheap, but you can make a great bouillabaisse with fairly inexpensive fish. I didn't spend
you
that much money.
Yeah.
I found a good buy on cod, a good buy on the rockfish.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was like $5.99 a pound, fresh, filleted.
Yeah. And you can, the cioppino that Mary mentioned was actually kind of created in San Francisco by the fishermen there and the Italians. And they, you know, would throw anything in that they had and they're with the tomato base.
The one thing about the meal, the seven fishes that I miss that I don't always find is eel.
Mm.
Fresh eel.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are repulsed by the idea that it's like eating a snake. Well, it's not.
No.
It's a really nice, white, thick source of protein. It's a really, and it's very tasty fish. You just have to remove the skin from it.
Well, you know, until recently, eel was the second biggest catch from the Chesapeake. Second biggest catch.
Until recently, meaning in the
last 20 years?
Yeah, yeah.
And, but very few people around here ate it on any kind of regular basis.
Right.
Yeah. So most of it was sent to Europe or to other places to use, which is kind of crazy, huh?
This is Midday on Eats with John Shields from Gertrude's and Donna Crivello of Donna's. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Please join us for conversation. Tell us how it turned out. I don't care what it is. It could be cookies, could be a stew you made, a roast you prepared. We've got some tweets on this that I'll read in a minute. But give us a ring and share your stories. Maybe you took on a big project for the holidays. You said, well, I'm going to have the whole family over. I've never done this before, but I'm going to make a lasagna. Tell us how your lasagna turned out. 410-662-8780. Fish cakes. Fish cakes. I made fish cakes. I had leftover tilapia. Tilapia's okay. I cooked it. I steamed it. And I pulled it all apart, and I mixed it with mashed potatoes and then some spices, and I made fish cakes.
Sounds good. Yeah.
It was good. Very good.
Yeah. We don't make enough fish cakes.
Fish cakes are good.
They are really, really good.
Well, it's also figuring out what to do with a leftover.
A leftover, yeah.
Instead of letting it sit around and then finally throwing it out.
By the way, A real quick seafood salad, because Mary mentioned calamari salad. Mm. I mean, that's easy to make.
Yeah,
and you don't have
that
to clean the calamari. You can find some already cleaned squid.
Right.
If you don't want to mess with it too much.
Yeah, you can buy it in the store. Yeah. You know, but you cut it up. Usually it's still in the, the tube.
In the tubulars,
You know, and then you cut it up in
the little rings.
Little rings.
And the little fingers, right? And you,
the
you steam it. It cooks quickly.
Steam it or give it a quick saute with a little olive oil and garlic and then throw in some capers and then.
Capers, parsley, garlic, olive oil, lemon juice. And sometimes I mix shrimp with this. I
do put shrimp
in. And calamari. That's a great salad.
But you might want to make the seafood separately and then put it all together because they'll
that's
cook
what I
it
do.
Different.
Yeah. That's what I do. I just steam
different
it.
Time.
Mm-hmm. It's also nice with mint.
I never thought of that.
A minted calamari. Mm. And you can put it in a little cocktail glass and have it really chilled. It's unbelievable.
With olive oil?
Olive oil. It has some lime and lime zest, a little bit of hot pepper in there, and a good bit of mint, and it's delicious.
Mint is really, it's kind of an underused herb, you know, and my grandmother used to put mint in the salad, and she'd put mint in her tomato sauce sometimes.
Yeah, my mother did, too.
Yeah.
Donna Crivello is with us from Donna's Cafe, and John Shields from Gertrude's Restaurant. This is Midday Eats, where we ask the question, how did it turn out? A recipe you tried, especially over the holidays, or a meal that you put on. Please tell us how it went. Here's Sherry in Baltimore. Sherry, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Something caught my eye in the grocery store as I was shopping for Christmas dinner. It was a box mix of gingerbread, pumpkin, bars, and it suggested that you could either make it in a pan as a bar or as a pie. So I did it as a pie, and I followed the instructions. I made the gingerbread, put it in the pie pan, pressed it into the pan, cooked it for 5 minutes, added the pumpkin pie filling, baked it. The pumpkin turned out beautifully. The gingerbread was hard as a rock and wouldn't come out of the pan. It was horrible. But I was intrigued by the idea of gingerbread and pumpkin. I thought, now that sounds wonderful.
It does sound like a good combination.
It does.
So I would be open to any suggestions about how to do it differently and use that same flavor combination again.
Well, what I would suggest with it is essentially going to a sweet pastry, but putting the gingerbread spices into that mix. So, you know, you're using cinnamon and nutmeg and cloves and the whole variety that would go if you were making a from scratch gingerbread cake. Because I think one of the problems in just putting a cake and using it as a crust, it doesn't seem like it's going to come out so well. You need a good bit of shortening. You need some fat in there to help solidify and get a good crust base on that.
I think the crust... Was it like a graham cracker crust?
It was dry. It wasn't like a batter, like a cake. It was kind of dry, like a graham cracker crust.
So it was almost a ground cookies, and then you had to add butter to it
and a little water,
and you added butter.
I added real butter.
And you sprayed the pan first.
I oiled the pan well. I did everything, but it it was just hard as a rock. So I like the idea of using the gingerbread spices in a crust.
I think I would maybe take graham crackers and then maybe spice those up a little bit.
Yeah, that would
and
work.
And add some butter to that and press it into a springform pan or a loaf pan.
Yeah.
But bake it maybe a little bit less.
Yeah.
Maybe the time of baking was off, and I don't know. Was
or
your
my oven,
oven
could be off too.
You know, that's a big problem for everybody is the unevenness of your oven, and also the temperature that you almost always have to put a thermometer in there because you think it's 350, but it's really 375. And with certain things, a 5 minute baking at 375 when you thought it was 350 could make or break the recipe.
Can throw it off.
But I like Sherry's call because she wants to try it again.
Yeah.
She wants to salvage this
thing.
And
it's a great idea.
Right. Yeah.
And great flavor combination. And it does bring us back to the Pillsbury biscuit, right, Dan?
Oh,
because
yeah.
we take the Pillsbury biscuit.
And put it in the center of the rack.
In the center of the rack, just as it says on the package, and do it exactly. And if it comes out and it's not right in any way, your oven's off.
Mm.
Because they test those things.
Yeah.
And that's what I did for my oven after we heard about it live right here on this show.
Well, there's another test you could do, and I read about this. You take, now I haven't done it, but it sounds like a great idea. You take a cookie sheet and you spread slices of white bread on that, and you bake it at 350. And you can see the evenness or the unevenness of the baking, and you're not wasting much by, you know, baking 12, you know, 10 or 12 pieces of bread.
Yeah.
And you can see left side dark, right side, you know, light, and then you'll know to, you know, turn things halfway through the baking.
Donna, here's a question for you from one of our listeners. Dan, Donna, and John, I made lasagna for the first time over the holidays, but the noodles stuck together. How do you handle lasagna noodles?
When you're boiling them.
What do you do? What do you
well,
do?
You,
what's your way? Because I got a way. But, so.
Well, number one is your water has to be really boiling, you know, kind of a vigorous boil. And then I put a little salt in the water. And oil helps, particularly if you're using fresh pasta. But when I put pasta in, as soon as you put the pasta in, you need to stir the water because now it starts to release its starchy, gluteny stuff.
Yeah.
And if you don't stir it, 5 minutes into the cooking and then another 5 minutes, you'll end up with everything sticking together. So three things, the hot boiling water, a little bit of oil and stirring, and then maybe one other thing, not overcrowding your pan with the pasta.
Because you want it to swim in there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's your words.
That's right,
you want
swimming.
Your noodles
the pasta
to swim.
Swim. Right.
And also a caution on using oil with any other pasta. I don't, when you're cooking spaghetti, for instance,
because you don't
You don't have to because actually your sauce is going to slip right off that. It won't stick as well to the spaghetti if you cook, I think, with oil in the water. This is what I do. So I strain the noodles out. I do what you do, but then when they're done and they're ready to come out, I strain them out of the big pot and I put them in ice water.
Yeah.
And then I dry them off using kitchen towels, clean kitchen towels.
Mm-hmm.
So that when I assemble the lasagna, they're not all wet still.
I think the shocking of putting in ice water is important. When I make the lasagna from scratch and I'm making the fresh dough, then I'll boil them, pull them out, and put them in ice water.
Okay, thank you, Donna. John and Donna, this is Matthew in Owings Mills joining us at 410-662-8780. Hi, Matthew.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions, and the first one is if you could just go into the differences between the fermented and the add vinegar sauerkrauts, because I know that there are two ways to ferment, and one is you put it in a jar and you add vinegar, and the other one is that you essentially allow it to ferment into vinegar with the jar, in the jar.
Okay.
Yeah,
John.
The vinegar method is like a quick make something that is sauerkraut-like.
Mm-hmm.
The way to make the sauerkraut, as Matthew said, is to let it ferment. And so you're just doing so simple. You know, it's just shredded cabbage, and it's salted, lightly salted, and you're building up layers of the salted cabbage. And then you're pressing it down because you want the cabbage to release the water. And it releases water. It covers the whole thing. And it takes about 5 weeks under normal temperatures for it to ferment.
Is that how you make sauerkraut?
Yeah. And what is the
there's
normal
no vinegar?
Temperature?
Excuse me. No. In your process, there's no vinegar?
Oh, no. There's never any vinegar in a sauerkraut.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because the other way that he's saying is to make it is to make it quickly and what? Let it marinate in vinegar.
Yeah, so you're getting that kind of taste. But otherwise, when I'm talking normal temperatures, you generally put it in a basement or a cool, mm-hmm. dry area. And so somewhere between 55 to 60 or 50 to 60 degrees is best. That's the best. But, you know, every year is different. And kraut is like a fine wine. Right. Depending on your year that you're brewing it,
yeah.
You could have a very warm fall.
Only on Midday Eats will you hear the phrase, sauerkraut is like a fine wine. John, I'm dying to ask you, how much sauerkraut do you have over at Gertrude's?
600 pounds of cabbage.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
600 pounds of cabbage. Where does the cabbage come from? Is it California cabbage?
No. It comes from Joan Norman, One Straw
Farm. Oh, yeah, One Straw Farm. Does she do 600 pounds
of
cabbage?
Yeah, they get it ready for us every year. They grow it for us every
locally
year.
Locally sourced.
Uh-huh.
Hey, that phrase, locally sourced, is in a tweet from Steve, who says that over the holidays he cooked goose sourced fresh, not frozen, from Eddie's Roland Park. Breast, cooked to 130, then pan-seared the skin down to crisp. Was very good. Root veggies roasted in goose fat were even better.
That sounds great.
What do you think of his method there?
Oh, I love it. I love it.
130 is good?
Yeah, that's a great way to do it. I mean, there's two different ways that you could do that. You can roast it, get it to 130, and then put it into a pan and crisp it up. Or you can go in the opposite direction, and you can crisp it up first in a pan, a real hot pan, get the skin nice and brown and crisp, and then finish it off in the oven to about 160.
Hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can I take Nancy's call? She's calling from the Eastern Shore, and she said she roasted a Canada goose for the holidays. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, how are you doing, Dan?
Good.
Yeah, my husband's a hunter, and he shot a Canada, and he had given one to a friend who had sent us a rough, here's what I did with it, and we tried it, and he brined it in for 24 hours in oranges and lemons and herbs and cider vinegar, and then we stuffed it with chestnuts and herbs and roasted it. It was delicious.
Sounds great.
I'm curious, how much did that goose weigh? Do you have any idea how much it weighed?
That's 7 or 8 pounds.
7 or 8 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And can I ask, when you were brining it, you said it had a little bit of vinegar. How much vinegar would you have used when you were doing that brine with the orange rind and everything?
It was one of those old-fashioned recipes where it says, shove in this and that. So we sort of poured in, might have been about a cup.
Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering, because I haven't tried that.
And the stuffing?
The stuffing was Campagna kind of bread, you know, it was a little old, and I threw it in the food processor, chopped up some onions and a little bit of celery. I had fresh parsley, thyme, and some sage, and a lot of chestnuts, at least half as many chestnuts as I put in bread.
Mm. Oh, that sounds lovely.
Great. Oh, boy, that sounds like a great meal. Thank you very much for that call, Nancy.
Okay.
Here's an email from Mary. Donna, she says, having lived in Bologna for many years, we always had roasted eel on Christmas Eve. Roasted eel. I don't know if I've ever had it that way.
No.
She wants to know where it would be available to buy, and I had the same question. I think you got to call Fadley's or what's the seafood place on Joppa Road?
Oh, yeah. Conrad's Crabs.
Yeah, I think you got to call somebody.
There's Sal's in Fells Point, and often he can get.
What's the name?
Fells Point. Sal's Seafood.
Sal's?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in Fells Point.
So if you call them and say, listen, I would like to get some eel. Can you call me when you get it?
They can often get it for
or
you.
Or it might be more, I haven't seen it in a long time on ice in any of our markets.
But no.
If there's an eel sighting out there, let us know. And it's really good.
Well, my grandmother used to dust it with flour and, you know, salt and pepper, and then just fry it in a pan.
Yeah, that's what my mom did. And if the skin was still on it, sometimes it would swim around in the pan.
It looked like it was jumping.
It did. Wasn't that weird? Because the skin would tighten up, and it's kind of spooky. Yeah. Let's see. Lauren in Sharpsburg. I like that town of Sharpsburg over there by the Potomac River.
I love cooking. This is real quick and easy for parents who have kids that are picky vegetable eaters. I discovered flavoring the water when you are cooking or boiling your haricot vert is a huge hit. And what I did was I just dumped in balsamic vinegar. I can't tell you how much, but I cooked the beans nice and soft, and then I seasoned them just with butter and onion salt. My kids were begging for seconds.
And you think the balsamic vinegar in the water that you cook the string beans in did it. I've never thought of that.
Did it change the color of the green beans?
It did. They got a little bit kind of ugly looking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think so. Probably not a dish for a restaurant, but it was so good. So I didn't.
A little bit of sugar.
Do you guys have any other suggestions for what other kinds of vinegars or flavors that you could add to your water that you're cooking your vegetables in?
Jeez, I never thought about that much other than salt.
Right. You know, or.
I know that
apple cider
we've
vinegar
talked about
might do something.
Apple cider vinegar?
Yeah.
That's
that,
interesting.
That could be nice.
We've talked on the show, Henry's made the point, and John, about when you're in the process of cooking and going through the steps, especially savory cooking, flavoring, flavor at every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And one example was an egg batter, an egg wash used for cooking, say, chicken cutlets or something like that, veal parmesan or something like that. A little bit of Dijon mustard in the egg wash.
Yeah.
Adds just a little bit more to that. And I tried it with fish and it, some tilapia, and it worked out pretty nicely.
Well, mustard is one of those secret ingredients that you can add to a lot of things. Say, you know, what you did, and then it's in vinaigrette. You can, you know, beat it into any other little savory mix you have.
Right, it adds a little something, doesn't it?
Yeah, because it has, well, anything that has salt, its own saltiness or its own tang, you know, I always think my my jar of red hot peppers, crushed red hot peppers, are a secret ingredient because it adds salt, it adds heat, it adds a little, you know, some of the little
Where
sour.
Does the salt come from? Is it natural to the pepper or is it something you do when you make it?
I buy it in a jar. I don't make them.
Oh, I see.
You know, you could make it, but that's one of those, you know, the jar of crushed
I know.
Yeah.
That peppers. Does that have salt in it? I didn't even notice that.
It does have salt in it, yeah.
Okay. Back to the phone lines. Geraldine in Elkton. Thank you for calling Midday. Hi.
Oh, I'm so happy to call. I was whisked away from Maine for 4 days by my new son-in-law, whose sister runs an organic farm in northern Maine, and had moose stew the first night I was there, shot by their 15-year-old daughter.
Wow.
And the next morning had hotcakes with maple syrup, but it was white flour hotcakes. And I thought, I have to eat these. But the next morning, I made them the hotcakes I make, and I thought, that's my gift to these farm workers in Maine, which is the Cornell University high-protein hotcakes, which I've been making for 20 or 25 years. So I stood there making that for 17 organic farm workers that were coming in from the 20-degree cold, you know, feeding the cows and all that stuff. And I hope to share it with you all.
Tell us about it.
Awesome recipe. It's one. This is for one. You know, one. Well, for me and my daughter, this is one recipe: 1 cup whole wheat flour, 1/4 cup cornmeal, 1/4 cup soy flour, one egg, 2 cups of milk, 2.5 tablespoons of butter. The rest of the dry ingredients are 1/4 of salt, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 teaspoon of baking powder, 3/4 teaspoon of baking soda, 2 tablespoons of sugar. I'm trying to think of what else is in there.
You know, this is interesting. It's called, we can look this up, by the way.
Joy of Cooking.
All right.
It's a 1972 or 73 edition.
Cornell University, you said, high-protein.
Cornell University, high-protein hotcake recipe.
Geraldine, we have to take a break, but I want to ask you this. What was the moose stew like?
It was so good. It was so rich. It's like deer. It's like venison.
Mm.
Big chunks of moose with potatoes, carrots, and onions, almost like an Irish stew, but the flavor of the moose was so incredibly rich. I couldn't believe it. It was so wonderful.
You know,
they used fresh baked bread dipped in oil. You know,
she had a moose stew in Maine. I love these calls that we get here. Geraldine, thank you very much. Now, I'm thinking a moose must really fill a freezer for a family, right? You send your 15-year-old daughter out to bag a moose in Maine.
How much meat did they get from
that
moose?
You got protein for the next 2 years,
yeah.
I think.
Uh-huh.
Listen, folks, we have to take another break. It's Midday Eats. Please join us as Geraldine did, 410-662-8780. I like that recipe for pancakes. What else? Oh,
blending
Midday, it. Midday, email address, midday@wypr.org. I got some emails here to read. A short break. We'll be right back. Here's an email from Anne who says, for a New Year's celebration, I made a coconut poke cake. P-O-K-E, a poke cake. It is either a white or coconut cake mix with fresh coconut added. Cook as a sheet cake. Then, when slightly cooled, poke holes in the top and pour over a can of sweet condensed milk and a can of cream of coconut purchased at an Asian market mixed together. Let it sit for quite a while, even in the fridge overnight. The icing was whipped heavy cream with toasted coconut. So incredibly moist and delicious. A coconut poke cake, P-O-K-E. She uses that phrase, sweet condensed milk. Mm. Condensed milk. I reached into the cupboard and I pulled out a can that looked like it's been there since 1955, and it said condensed milk. I thought it was evaporated milk because there's a similar can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was it Borden's or something like
You're
that?
You're right, it's Borden's.
Uh-huh. Condensed milk is sweetened condensed milk, right?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
use this in baking a lot,
right?
Yeah, it's
sweet. It's very sweet.
Oh, I don't know what to do with it. And the top of the can was getting a little rusty, so I...
Did you use it?
No, no, I didn't.
No,
because
no,
I didn't know what to
either.
Use it. I didn't know what it was doing there. And evaporated milk, I saw a recipe for macaroni and cheese that called for evaporated milk. What's the deal with that? Why would it call for evaporated milk?
I think that it's thicker, and instead of using heavy cream...
Is that what you get with evaporated milk?
I think so, but I have to tell you, I'm not an expert on evaporated or condensed milk.
Okay.
Well, evaporated milk, you would find that a lot in 1930s, 1940s, 50s cooking. When I did a lot of research on the Chesapeake books, anytime I would go down southern Maryland, and then especially the islands, Smith Island, Tangier Island, all the recipes call for evaporated milk or tinned milk, because milk, fresh milk, was not available.
Yeah,
right. You didn't have to refrigerate it.
So you would. This was a revolution to these people to be able to have that and for it to be shelf stable.
And probably some of these recipes that call for the condensed or the evaporated milk are really old recipes.
Yes, that were adapted to that. Yes.
This is Midday Eats, our January edition of it. Henry Hong wasn't feeling well, couldn't join us today, but Donna Crivello is here from Donna's Cafes. I want to mention that Donna, she likes to teach. She teaches a lot, has some classes coming up. January 20th, a class focused on stew, including seafood stew, right, Donna? Okay. And then February 17th, classes on pasta, homemade pasta.
Homemade pasta.
Excellent. And folks can find out how to sign up for the classes through, is it donnas.com?
That's right. They can go to the website.
donnas.com. Mm-hmm. That's simple.
That's
all right.
It.
Thank you, Donna. And John Shields is here, of course, from Gertrude's in the Baltimore Museum of Art. Blaze wrote in to say that you can likely get eels at one of the Asian markets out on Route 40 West, H Mart, or I think there's another one out there. And I didn't get a chance to go out there. There's the other seafood market that I discovered in place of the old San Antonio's supermarket in Highlandtown is G Mart, has quite a large fresh seafood selection. Susan in Baltimore, we'll go to you next. Thanks for calling Midday.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, Susan.
Yeah, I was going to share that I made my wedding cake. I'm a senior. We were getting married for the, it was the second time around, I guess, for each of us. And it was 2 days, the wedding was 2 days after Christmas. And since I make my grandson's birthday cakes, I decided that I wanted to make our wedding cake. And so it was going to be five layers because we were having a lot of people. And I made the first layer was going to be carrot cake with a cream cheese filling with Bailey's Irish cream in it. The second layer was chocolate with chocolate mousse filling. The third was vanilla with lemon curd filling. And the fourth was strawberry, because that's what my husband likes, with chocolate filling. And then the fifth was the vanilla with the lemon again. But what I was really pleased with was the carrot cake, because I had never, ever made a carrot cake before. And so I tried four different recipes and had friends and relatives try them all. And one came out ahead of the others. But then to that one, I added, besides carrots, oh, it was made with oil and applesauce was in this recipe. But I also added, like, dark raisins, golden raisins, walnuts, and pineapple with the juice. And it was a 16-inch round. Anyway, wow.
Boy, Susan, you were really happy about getting married.
Yeah.
I've got to ask you, this is your own invention, your own design.
Yeah. I wanted the buttercream, buttercream icing, because even though fondant looks prettier, buttercream tastes a whole lot better.
Yeah, but what I'm getting at is, thank you, Susan, is the layering of this. So I'm trying to imagine how this looks when you get a slice on your plate. Each is separated by the filling, right? So you get to sample the carrot cake, then move on to the chocolate part, then the vanilla. Then
often when you have a cake that tall, you'll cut one layer, and then you'll cut another layer and another layer.
Oh, is that how it was done? So she didn't.
I want a piece of the carrot. I want a piece of the chocolate.
I'm imagining, you know, all of it on one plate. Oh no. Okay. Is that how it works, Susan?
Each tier was a different cake.
Oh boy, that would be tough to make a decision. I guess.
Well, how long did it take you?
It really
didn't take that long. I started the week before. I started on Saturday night baking each cake. And I'd say by Tuesday, I'd finished baking the cakes and icing each one.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took them separately to, it was the synagogue, and in their kitchen, I put it together.
Yeah.
Mm.
So your favorite layer was the carrot cake.
Yeah.
And traditionally...
Go ahead, Dawn.
I was going to say, traditionally, the fruit cakes were always a wedding cake, because you could make it in advance and then ice it, and it would stay longer. And
really?
It would get better as it sat. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's okay. Here's Alice by email. She says, I keep a tub of miso paste in my refrigerator, and I've recently discovered, especially when making vegetable dishes or soups, that when it seems to be lacking something, I add a heaping tablespoon to the pot of soup. It seems to add that slightly meaty flavor that seems to be missing in vegetable soup so often. It is especially good in a cabbage and onion stew with a little celery, winter squash, a chopped apple, and a sausage cut into small pieces. So a little bit of miso.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And it works lovely. The only thing that you want to keep in mind when you're doing that is you don't want to be boiling it. It has to be put in during a simmer, and you don't want to bring it back to a boil. That's the only thing to think. But it gives a great flavor, whether the red miso or the yellow miso, they're both lovely.
Dave in Harford County calling with a question for us on Midday Eats. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good.
Hey, I wonder if your guest could help me with a failed crock pot meatloaf recipe my wife made over the holidays. It tasted great. It was very succulent, but it sat in so much of its own liquid that we were not able to get it out of the crock pot to serve it. It fell apart. So I wondered if anyone has ever tried cooking in a crock pot with a stand or some type of a rack, or whether this recipe should just go in the regular oven.
Well,
if you got a regular oven,
I always vote for a regular oven.
Okay. Yeah. If you want to do a slow cooker meatloaf, you're talking to the right guy.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I had the same problem, Dave. It ends up in this it ends up in a swamp of greasy
soft
water, and it's too soft. So you take the lid off for the last hour or so. That's it.
Is that it?
Yeah. It doesn't evaporate all the water, but the top gets a little bit of a crust on it, just a little bit, and the sides start to not burn, but the sides get a little roasted.
Caramelize a little.
Nice.
Thank you. Yeah. Caramelize. And there's a little less liquid by the time you take it out.
Yeah.
So it's not as good as if it's in the regular oven.
Yeah, I think the oven's the way to go. Now, when I cook in the oven, I take that pan and drain it once or twice.
Yeah.
Is there any way to do that with the crock pot, or just too dangerous?
I take the lid off. I don't let it cook with a lid on. And that removes some of the liquid. But I don't think it's dangerous to take a, what is it called, that you use?
Like
a baster.
A turkey baster.
A turkey baster and remove some of it.
Yeah,
I got two of those. You want one of them?
I will give it a try.
Yeah. You just don't burn yourself. Okay. You won't. Alan in Long Green calling with
Hey, Dan.
Hi.
Just two answers to your question of what to do with that sweetened condensed milk. The Borden, it's the Eagle brand, and one of them is practical and one of them is fun. The practical one is that's the key ingredient in key lime pie. So quick use for that, couple of ingredients, 20 minutes in the oven, and you've got a great key lime pie. But the second is more fun. Take that can of sweetened milk, peel the label off, drop it in a pot of boiling water, and boil it for an hour in the can, closed. And it's the most amazing caramel sauce you've ever had.
Really?
Dulce de leche.
Yeah.
That's dulce de leche, isn't
yeah.
it? That's uh-huh. the poor man's version of it.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing stuff.
And the little bit of rust on the top of the can, it's...
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Well.
There must be a date on it. I'll have to go home and check. Thanks for the advice, though, Alan. I appreciate that. Irene and Timonium, we'll go to you next. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You talked about cooking vegetables, and I, like, if you want to, tell you how to cook my carrots.
Please.
I use a little bit of olive oil and some butter, and then I add chopped fresh ginger, about a tablespoon, and then the chopped carrots, and let them get a little bit brown, and then add a bit of salt and a bit of orange juice, and they taste really good.
Oh,
and
thank you,
what
Irene.
Temperature?
Yeah.
Are you sauteing or are you roasting them?
No, sauteing.
Sauteing, okay.
Mm. That
yeah.
sounds great.
Thank you very much for that
sounds great.
Recommendation. Michelle writes in to say that she cooked two rabbits for Christmas. One recipe was one that I found online, which suggested roasting for about 45 minutes after marinating with garlic, olive oil, and rosemary for an hour. The other recipe was from my 85-year-old uncle, who suggested I marinate the rabbit in garlic, olive oil, and cumin for at least a day. I marinated it for 2 days and roasted it until the rabbit was golden brown. Of course, my uncle's recipe was perfect. We have been looking forward to a rabbit dinner since Thanksgiving when I missed my opportunity to purchase one at the Dutch Farmers Market in Laurel. I came about 45 minutes after they sold the last one. This time I made sure to call before I went to pick them up. It was a perfect ending to a perfect Christmas. Have you ever cooked rabbit, John?
Oh, yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Just like chicken? How do you handle
well,
it?
Well, I mean, all kinds of different ways. I mean, generally, I would braise it. I always like to do rabbit maybe with a mustard cream sauce. You can roast it. You could do the whole thing and stuff it. There's a couple of French versions that it's stuffed with spinach and leeks and mushrooms wrapped in bacon, and then the whole thing is roasted.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is Sicilian, where it's an agrodolce, where you brown it, braise it, and add a little bit of vinegar and something sweet in with it, too.
Alex also has a suggestion for evaporated milk. Not condensed, evaporated. Hello, Alex. We don't have time for the whole recipe. Is it something you could email us? Or?
Sure. I could email it to you. It's delicious. It's made with marshmallow cream also.
Marshmallow cream. Evaporated milk to make a fudge.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And it's really, really light. It's not a very dense fudge. It's a very light, fluffy fudge. It's delicious.
Well, you know, we could post it on Facebook or on our website if you send us a recipe.
Sure.
All right.
No
would you? It's midday at WYPR.org. And John, you sent us a recipe today.
I did for the chocolate sauerkraut.
For the
cake.
Sauerkraut
yep,
cake.
Yep. And pictures and everything with it.
So people are going to show up tonight,
yeah.
And they're going to go through 600 pounds of sauerkraut?
Well, 300 pounds tonight, 300 pounds tomorrow. And we have Joy of Maryland, which is one of the premier polka orchestras in the Baltimore metropolitan
really?
Area. So they're going to polka their hearts out and eat a lot of sauerkraut and all the
sounds
accoutrement.
Great.
That sounds great. That's the annual Krautfest at Gertrude's, but it's also loud,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
Thanks for being here again, John.
Well, thank you, Dan.
John Shields from Gertrude's in the Baltimore Museum of Art, who joins us once a month for Midday on Food, or Midday Eats. And Donna Crivello, again, her classes, January 20th for stews, February 17th for making homemade pasta. More information at donnas.com. Donna's
thank
Cafe.
You.
It's nice to have you with us, Donna.
Nice to be here.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in today and taking part in the show. And have a great weekend. Go Ravens. We'll see you on Monday.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.